Welcome to the weekly podcast from Christ Community Church. If you would like more information about this podcast or Christ Community Church, please visit our webpage at www.gochristcommunity.com. Blessings and enjoy the sermon.
Good to have you all out this morning. I usually like to start with a little bit of humor, so let's see. Who were the poorest animals aboard Noah's Ark? The poorest animals. Well, it wasn't the doe, because she at least had a buck. But the poorest animals were the skunks. You see, they only had 2 cents. Oh, yes, okay. And who are the most ornery and contrary animals aboard Noah's Ark? Well, it was the horses. See, they were always saying, nay, nay. And what animals on Noah's Ark just kept dying over and over again? What animals kept dying over and over again? It was the frogs. They just kept croaking and croaking. Okay, enough of that. We got a lot to cover today. So today we're going to be looking at biomimetics means. If you remember from last time, biomimetics is the field of science where scientists and engineers increasingly are looking to the world of biology to try to find design and engineering solutions that we can adapt to our own technology. But what we're going to look at, especially today, is that a lot of inventions and innovations that man thought he was the first one to think of and invent, actually God had already invented it from the beginning of creation. So man is not the great innovator, he's really the great copier, even when he doesn't even know he's copying God's design. He found out later, oh, well, God thought of it first. God invented it first, because he is the great inventor and creator. So biomimetics, or biomimicry, means God invented it first. And this is part two. Oh, thank you. Yes, got to water the elephant. Okay. Now, one thing that we have invented that obviously was invented before, the suction cup. I use these, you know, on my GPS. It works pretty good until it falls down. You know, everything works until it doesn't. And God, of course, invented that first with the marvelous creature, the octopus. Now, what is this? An air conditioner? You living in Nevada should know better. What is it? Swamp cooler, yes. And it uses evaporative cooling. Runs water through there, draws air through, and evaporation, of course, liberates a lot of thermal energy and produces cooling effect. But a swamp cooler, a use of evaporative cooling attached to a thermostat that regulates temperature up and down, man didn't invent that first. God invented it first, and he did it with these amazing creatures, the honeybees. The honeybees have to maintain an optimum temperature in the hive of about 95 degrees is the optimum. But if it gets too cold in the winter, if it falls below 50 degrees in the winter, they all die. And if it gets much more over 100 degrees in the summer, the wax can melt, they lose all their honey, they lose their young, be catastrophe. So they have to regulate the temperature. Now, in the winter, they're not out foraging. So you can have tens of thousands of bees in the hive, and they accumulate on the honeycomb, and they kind of rev their engines. You know, they kind of buzz and contract their muscles, and that produces increased body heat. But they all have a built-in thermometer. So they rev their engines until the temperature comes up maybe a degree or so above the optimum, then they stop. And then when it drops maybe a degree below the optimum, they rev up again. And they have their honey to provide them energy through the winter, because they stored that up, you know, during the spring and summer, so they can regulate their hive temperature during the winter. But what about the summer, when it gets really hot? Well, that's where they go out and they fill their nectar sac that they ordinarily fill with nectar that they turn into honey. They fill that with water. Then they come back and put little drops of water all over the honeycomb. Then a bunch of them get at the front of the hive and they fan their wings and blow a forced draft through the hive, just like the swamp cooler. And, of course, when the temperature drops too low, they stop fanning. And then when it comes up a little bit, they fan again. Same principle as a swamp cooler with a built-in biological thermostat. So God invented it first. Now, what do we have here? Clay tablet with intelligent written language on it. Does anybody recognize the language? Well, it's a cuneiform. Yeah, it took our linguists a long time to figure it out, too. But written language is not even something that man invented. God invented it first from the very beginning of creation, and if he didn't, no living organism could live or reproduce. He invented it, of course, in DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, the Blueprint Molecule of Life. It contains all the blueprint instructions for the growth and self-maintenance and eventual reproduction of all living creatures. It's actually a three-dimensional code, since it's not just flat, it's in three dimensions, like a spiral staircase. And it is incredibly complex. We didn't know that in Darwin's day. Darwin didn't even know about DNA. But we certainly know about it in the 21st century. Its complexity is so great that a conservative calculation is that the odds of getting it by chance is 1 chance in 10 to the power of 2,200. Okay, that's number one with 2,200 zeros after it. For comparison, the estimated number of atoms in the universe is only about 10 to the power of 80, number one with 80 zeros. This is 2,200 zeros behind it. Each time you add a zero to that number, it makes it 10 times greater than the previous huge number. So 10 to the 80th number of atoms in the universe, 10 to the 81st 10 times, 10 to the 82nd 100 times, 10 to the 83rd 1,000 times the atoms in the universe. What about when you get up to 2,200 zeros? Well, it's simply incomprehensible. It means if you had trillions times trillions of years and trillions times trillions of universes as big as ours, and every planet had plenty of DNA that was randomly mutating, you couldn't come close to get one correctly structured DNA that would actually function with the right bonds, with the right order of the nucleotides, excluding non-biological compounds. Absolutely impossible. But it can happen. How? Just like that clay tablet, an intelligent mind, knowing language, knowing the rules of language, imposes it on the clay. In this case, God imposed it in biochemistry, and it carries meaningful information that is read by automated robots, robots called RNA and enzymes, that work with it, understand it, translate it into first the RNA language and then finally into the protein language, which is a language of structure and function in biology. So no living creature could exist if God didn't invent language first, because it's information stored in this language DNA that is deciphered, interpreted, understood, and translated by other biochemical machines that makes life possible. Now then, here we have camouflage netting being put on military equipment. This is to keep the enemy from seeing it if they have drones or reconnaissance aircraft flying over. But the concept of camouflage to defeat your enemy is not something that man thought of. God thought of it and gave it to many animals we see in the world of biology. Men, of course, like to camouflage themselves, so they're not quite an easy target. But here we have the Egyptian nightjar bird. As you can see, its mottled feathers are designed to fit in with its sandy, dusty environment. When it's nestled on the sand like that, it almost disappears. And what do we have here? Anybody know? If you look closely, it's a lizard. But the lizard's skin and color is designed to match almost perfectly with the trunk of this tree. Now, snipers have known for a long time that when they wear their sniper suit called a ghillie suit, that if they know where they're going to be sniping ahead of time, they go to that environment and they take grasses and plants from that environment and weave it into their ghillie suit so that they'll match perfectly the environment that they're in. But even that is not a new idea. God thought of it first, and he gave it to this amazing creature, the decorator crab. The decorator crab takes pieces of sponge and adheres it to its body with a kind of a biological superglue, and then it nestles among the sponges, and predators that come around looking for crabs pass it over because it looks like a sponge, not a crab. And what do we have here? The sandy hunter bug, an appropriate name. It lives in a sandy environment, and it extrudes a kind of a biological glue on its skin, and then it rolls in the sand. So it gets exactly the type of sand in that particular environment, just like the sniper, so he blends in perfectly. Now, we have a wood grain background here, so there's a sharp contrast, but if he was on sand, he'd be virtually invisible. And what do we have here? The world's longest insect, not the biggest and heaviest, but the longest insect in the world is, anybody know what it's called? The walking stick. And that's one way to make yourself disappear, look like something you're not. It actually looks like a twig with branches, but it is actually the world's longest insect. And we have other varieties, such as the prickly green walking insect, which hides very well among briars where you have prickly branches around it. And does anybody know what kind of caterpillar this is? Well, it's actually a worm or caterpillar that metamorphoses into the peppered moth that, you know, Darwinists seem to think prove evolution and everything. But it's interesting that it can appear in a green form on a green limb or a brown form on a brown limb. Now, I don't know I'll have to do further research on this. I don't know if it's like a chameleon that can change its color based on its background, or when the egg is laid, if some kind of biochemical message registers the color of the stem, and when it comes out, it's either brown or green, depending on what branch egg was laid on. But I don't think things like this actually happen by chance, do you? A bunch of random mutations. Now, here we have the hooded grasshopper, which has this big hood that looks like a leaf. And when it nestles among other leaves, it becomes, again, virtually indistinguishable. It just looks like a leaf. Now, here we have the broken leaf bug, broken leaf insect. And it looks like a broken leaf, but it is, in fact, an insect. If this is on the ground, somebody think, oh, it's just some broken leaf on the ground. Easy to pass it up, not realize that it could be an insect that could be eaten. But it's an amazing camouflage, making it look like something that it's not. Now, here we have the leaf grasshopper. Now, the leaf grasshopper looks pretty much like a conventional grasshopper from the side angle like this. But when it wants to, it gets in a leafy environment, and it pulls its legs, big long legs and other legs underneath it. It flattens out its wings, and guess what it looks like? It looks just like a leaf, including the veins of the leaf. Just amazing camouflage. And here we have the leafy sea dragon. This, of course, nestles and floats among seaweed. And it looks like just a broken piece of seaweed floating, you know, in the current, but it actually is a living creature. Now, another problem you have with camouflage is even if your coloration matches your background, sharp contrast of a shadow can betray your presence. And so we have learned with camouflage to use flanging and fringing. Flanging means you put out side panels that help to cover up that shadow, and then you fringe it at the edge to make it blend in. This works very effectively. However, man was not the first one to think of this and invent it. God invented it first, and we see it here. Where is the creature in this picture? Well, believe it or not, it is a caterpillar, and it has flattened itself against this limb here with flanging and fringing. It looks like it has become part of the tree limb itself. Very effective flanging and fringing form of camouflage. God invented it first. Now, does anybody know the name of this World War II fighter? The F-6F Hellcat with the R-2800 2,000 horsepower radial engine, also used in the P-47 Thunderbolt and used in the F-4U Corsair. Very powerful engine on some of our best fighters. This was our chief carrier fighter in the Pacific in World War II. And it has the distinction of having the greatest kill ratio of any U.S. fighter in World War II. Anybody know what the kill ratio was? 19 to 1. Yeah, very effective against the Japanese Nakajima and Zero fighters. Now, being carrier-based fighters mean they were flying over the ocean a lot. The great Marianas turkey shoot, you know, they got 350-some enemy aircraft in a single day, but they're flying all over the ocean. Now, in a three-dimensional environment, to camouflage, your enemy could be beneath you or he could be above you. So if they're looking up at it, maybe trying to shoot it down with anti-aircraft artillery, it has a light blue color on the bottom to mimic the background of the light blue sky. But if the enemy is looking down from above, they have a dark blue on the top, and that's to mimic the dark blue color of the ocean below. So whether they're looked at from below or above, they have camouflage, kind of a two-tone camouflage. But two-tone camouflage, again, is not something man thought of and started using in World War II. God thought of it first, and he gave it to many fish, most notably sharks, of all things. They have a light underbelly, so if you're looking at them from beneath, it tends to blend in with the light brightness of the surface of the ocean, which is bright from sunlight. But if you're looking down on it, the dark gray matches the dark gray ocean bottom with sand and mud, etc. Now, here we have the biomimetic squid. It's actually bioluminescent squid. And it uses bioluminescence, which is God's means in biology of producing a very efficient form of cold light, light that gives almost hardly any heat. Now, our incandescent bulbs and our fluorescent bulbs, you'll notice, give off a lot of heat. That's actually wasted energy because heat is in the infrared spectrum. You can't even see it with your eyes. So it's using energy that you can't even use to see. But this uses energy that's the most efficient light energy that we know of. And it uses an oxidative process based on the mixing of two biochemicals. One is luciferin, which sounds like Lucifer, because Lucifer's name before he fell was actually a good name. It meant the illuminated one, or the one who bears light. So luciferin, biochemical compound with luciferase, a catalytic enzyme. When they combine, they oxidize and produce chemical light that is cold, doesn't give off hardly any heat at all. It's almost all given off invisible light, so it's incredibly efficient. But this has cells that illuminate with this bioluminescence just the number of cells so that if you're looking up at it from below, it'll match the bright color of the surface of the ocean. They'll try to match that perfectly, turning only enough cells on to match it. And if you're looking at it from above, it remains dark, so it'll blend in with the dark bottom of the ocean. Another means of two-tone camouflage. Now, anybody know the name of this particular creature? The chameleon. A lot of people think that the chameleon is the only one that God gave the amazing ability to change its color to match its background. But there are other creatures, and they do it by means of these amazing melanophore cells. These cells have spots in it of pigment, of color, and different colors and different color combinations can be arranged to match the background so perfectly that they seem to disappear. It's almost like Harry Potter's invisibility cloak. You know, it works almost that good. And we still don't understand exactly how it works. Somehow, through its eyes and brain, it takes a picture of the background and then sends that message to these cells that rearrange the melanophores or the melanin pigments, you know, to match the background. Somehow it does it. It's certainly not anything I think happened by chance. But it works very effectively, and it works in frogs and in fish of certain types. The flounder is one that can match its background. Now, this one has just landed on the sandy bottom. Within a few minutes, it will match the color and texture of the sandy bottom to where it will virtually disappear. In fact, here we have flounders. This flounder is trying to match a multicolored background. And this one, we have a flounder here too. Can you see it? In just a few minutes, it matched that background to where it disappeared. What's really interesting, and you can look at it on YouTube, they took a flounder and put it in a big aquarium, and they put a checkerboard pattern on the bottom of the aquarium, something the flounder would never encounter in the natural world. And yet it nestled on the bottom, and it did a checkerboard on it to match that background. It's just amazing what it can do. Now, here we have an interesting octopus. Anybody know the name of this octopus? It's called the mimic octopus. And the mimic octopus is well named because it mimics other creatures to try to make itself look more dangerous than it is, or to look innocuous, like it's something that's not something that a predator might want to eat. Now, in one case, it pulls back its legs like this to look like a flat flounder, and it swims right along the bottom, just like a flounder, so that creatures that like to eat octopus but don't care about flounder will overlook it. Another thing it does is make itself look like the lionfish, spreads out its arms like that to make it look like the lionfish. Now, why do predators avoid the lionfish? Anybody know? Well, those big fins at the end of them have neurotoxin that would sting like crazy. So if you've ever encountered a lionfish, you know to give them a wide berth. So by mimicking something more dangerous than itself, it deters predators. One of its most effective mimics is it mimics the deadly sea snake. Those things are so venomous that most predators and everything else give them a wide berth, don't want to get near them. But it'll bury all of its arms in the sand and leave just two arms out that it maneuvers around like a sea snake. And since it has the coloration of a sea snake, it's a very convincing bluff. But all that wisdom God put in the mimic octopus. Now we're going to look at General Patton's ghost army. The interesting thing is that Patton, you know, was a great general, and he eventually, in the invasion of Europe, led the Third Army, Armored Division, and did many great exploits against the Germans. But he actually got relieved of command because he had slapped a couple of foot soldiers suffering from what today we call PTSD. Back then they called it shell shock or battle fatigue. But they were there in the infirmary. They didn't have any visible wounds. And he said, "What are you here for?" "Well, you know, we've lost our nerve." And he just slapped them and said, "Yeah, get out there and fight, you know." Well, the higher command did not look good on that, slapping soldiers that had PTSD. So he was actually relieved of command. And the Germans thought, "Oh, that's a ruse. That's a ploy. He's their best commander. If they invade Europe, surely he is going to be the commander. He's their best strategist." So they would not relieve him because he slapped a couple of foot soldiers. That must be a trick. And they used that to actually fool the Germans. They said, "General Patton has been put in command of the First Army." Now, there never was a First Army. It was a ghost entity. It was something they made up. But they claimed that the First Army was stationed here in Kent, England, right across the narrowest stretch of the English Channel. And this was obviously the easiest and perhaps the most obvious route for the invasion of Europe, because if you come across here to Normandy, it's over 100 miles. If a storm kicks up or anything, that's a lot of miles to get through. You could get ships sunk, you could lose equipment. It's only a little over 20 miles here. People actually swim that, you know, the English Channel there from Kent to Pas-de-Calais. So they put this big ghost army there, had all kinds of radio traffic. Yeah, we're doing troop maneuvers here, we're doing tank battles here, we're doing war games here. They had all this radio traffic. They made sure that Patton, who wasn't commanding anything at the time, he was relieved of command, that he was there as the commander of the First Army. And the spies could see, yeah, he's there, he's rallying the troops and everything. And they even had spies that were double agents saying, yes, this is where the invasion is going to come. Now, they're going to make a diversion. They're going to make a diversionary attack here at Normandy. And the reason is because the crack panzer units, the tank units, are back here, where they thought would be the most obvious attack route. They say they're going to attack at Normandy, so we'll pull our panzers over here. Then they'll come in behind us with the main invasion, split our forces in two, and take over Europe. That sounded like a neat plan. Hitler thought, well, that makes sense. But why were they so convinced that there was a real army here? Well, it was not just because of the radio traffic. It wasn't just because of the presence of Patton there. It wasn't just because their double agent spies were saying it was so. It's because their aerial reconnaissance showed a huge army there. But it wasn't a real army. It was an army made up of inflatables. Yeah. M4 Sherman tank weighed anywhere from 30 to 33 tons in its various versions. It could not be picked up by four men. But they moved these things around. They had to make phony tank tracks leading up to them. So from the aerial reconnaissance looked like tank maneuvers and everything. But they not only made a bunch of tanks, they made, you know, inflatable trucks. You know, they made tanks that had the turrets that could come off. The turret weighed 7 tons, heavier than the heaviest African elephant. So men could not pick it up if it was real. So it was very convincing from the air. Here we have an aircraft, again, that looked like it was real, B-26 Marauder. Here we have inflatable artillery. It needs a little more inflation to look more formidable. And here's one of the most convincing things they did, inflatable landing craft. Now, in Operation Sea Lion, which was the code name for the German invasion of Great Britain, the aerial reconnaissance of the British showed they didn't have any credible landing craft at all. Hitler was just bluffing. He said, we're going to invade. You either surrender or we're going to invade. Well, he didn't have any good landing craft. So we had the Battle of Britain instead with the aircraft. But they made sure they made plenty of these inflatable. Notice the sailors are pushing on that. That's supposed to be a steel door. It won't bend if it's steel. But it looks very convincing from the air. They put a whole bunch of these across from Pas-de-Calais. So it looked like, boy, they have the means. They have a huge army there, the First Army, commanded by General Patton. They're ready to go for, you know, a big invasion. Across from Normandy, they had all the landing craft, but they were covered up. So aerial reconnaissance couldn't see them. So it looked like, well, they have a little force at Normandy for a phony invasion, for a distraction, you know. But the real force is here across from Pas-de-Calais. So one of their main double agents, codenamed Garbo, he said, you know, that's exactly what's going to happen. They're going to make a feint at Normandy. It'll be to distract you and draw your forces over there, but they're really going to come in with the main force at Pas-de-Calais. And they believed it because this ghost army looked so real from the air. In fact, they never did come at Pas-de-Calais. Hitler was so convinced that they would that for weeks he withheld his crack tank panzer units at Pas-de-Calais, giving them a free run out of Normandy for 2 or 3 weeks without opposition, from tanks at least. So it worked very well indeed. Now most people know the name of this beautiful butterfly. Anybody know the name? Monarch? You're wrong. See, God was the first one to come up with the idea of looking more dangerous than you are to confuse your enemy. Patton's army made us look very formidable at Pas-de-Calais, but we were very weak. It was a bunch of inflatables. The real army was across from Normandy. Why do predators avoid the monarch butterfly? Because it contains milkweed toxin, and if they eat it, they get violently sick and have to vomit it out. If they eat too much, they die. So if they ever eat a monarch, they go, boy, I'm never going to eat one of those orange butterflies again. They're toxic. Well, this is the viceroy butterfly. It uses the same principle as Patton's army. Look dangerous, even when you're not, and you'll confuse your enemy, and they'll make a wrong decision. Now, on the left, we have the real monarch butterfly. On the right, the viceroy As you can see, there are only subtle differences. It looks enough like a monarch that just like it fooled you, it often fools predators too. Now, what do we have here? A coral snake? A baby coral snake? You know, even a baby snake can be venomous. This is actually a long caterpillar. But in nature, when you see bright colors, white and black stripes, see that type of pattern? It's like advertising. I'm not trying to camouflage and blend in. I'm dangerous. I'm poisonous. I'm advertising, you know, leave me alone because I'm trouble. Well, again, you can make yourself look dangerous even though you're not. It's not a coral snake. It's a harmless caterpillar in the tropics. Oh, what's this, a barn owl? Well, it looks kind of like a barn owl with the big eyes and even looks like a beak there. But it's actually a moth. But predators that are afraid of barn owls would give wide berth to this. They know there's a big barn owl on that tree. I'm going away. But it's just a harmless moth. And here we have, what on earth is this? My wife said it looks like an alien of some kind. Well, it looks kind of like the head of a snake with some big eyes. And if you're crawling through the grass and you see those big eyes, you're not going to wait to take a second look and see what it really is. You can think, that's the head of a snake. I'm getting out of here. Actually, it's the rear end of a toad. But with those big eyes, it makes it look like the head of a snake, convincingly enough that many predators would back off. And here we have, anybody know the name of this big moth in the tropics? It's called the Atlas moth. And as you may note, at the end of its wings, it has what looks like the eye and the mouth and the head of a cobra. This pattern is repeated both on the back and on the underside, so that when it rests on a tree and it pulls its wings together, you see what looks like two heads of a cobra facing out. Well, most people seeing cobra heads would definitely back off, but it's really just a harmless moth. Oh, and what is this? Well, looks like a baby snake. You're climbing up a tree and you see that pop out of a leaf, you're likely to climb right back down, because even baby snakes can be venomous, but it is a harmless caterpillar. And this caterpillar looks even more dangerous. It looks very much like a snake, and it has an instinct that if you touch it, it'll actually strike at you as if it's a snake trying to strike. It doesn't have any fangs or anything, but it'll bluff you, and it looks enough like a snake that most people and the predators would back off. So looking like you're dangerous when you're not can give you an advantage over your enemies. Well, God thought of that first. Man thought of it too. Here we have on the Russian steppes tanks that are covered with foliage to make them look like a series of bushes on the plains. So aerial reconnaissance wouldn't see them. There's a bunch of bushes down there, but nothing dangerous. But in fact, it is dangerous tanks. This was also used by Montgomery in North Africa against Rommel, where they took Centurion tanks and covered them up to look like just mere troop transports. So the aerial reconnaissance of the Luftwaffe to fly over, well, they got a bunch of troop transports. They got a lot of troops there with small arms. Don't seem to have any armor. Well, we'll just send our armor down there and we'll just wipe them out. Well, when they sent their armor, they got met with tanks because they only thought they were weak. They were actually strong. Now, anybody know the name of this particular famous tank, American tank in World War II? It's the M4 Sherman. When it was first produced in 1942 and used in North Africa against Rommel, it was one of the best tanks on a par with the best tanks in the world. Problem was they started mass producing it and didn't realize you got to keep up with the Joneses. Now, the Germans had a nasty encounter with the T-34 tank the Russians produced, which was better than their Mark III and Mark IV tank. And they were surprised that these subhuman Slavics could produce a better tank than they had. So they went back to the drawing board, and they produced the Panther tank and the Tiger tank, and eventually the King Tiger tank, which outclassed any of the T-34s. But we didn't learn that lesson. We're just in a mass production, you know, crank them out. So a lot of these were cranked out with the old short barrel that had a low-velocity round that worked well against the tanks in North Africa but could not penetrate a Panther or a Tiger at all. So the Germans despised the M4 Sherman. They called it the door knocker. So it'll shoot at you and it'll be like somebody knocking on the door. It can't penetrate your armor. So the only way the Sherman could defeat a Tiger or a Panther would be to maneuver around the side or the rear where their armor was thinner. Could not penetrate the frontal armor unless it got within 60 yards, which would basically be suicide. So the British had the right idea. Let's upgrade the Sherman. And they came out with a version called the Firefly. And that's this version. See, this is the normal length of the barrel, but this has one more than twice as long. Long barrel gives higher velocity. They put their best anti-tank cannon in it, the British 17-pounder. They called it the Firefly because when it fired, there was such a big flash of flame that both the gunner and the captain had to be trained to close their eyes when they shot because just like a flash in your eyes, you know, you get that afterglow and you can't see for a while. And that's not very good when you're in the middle of combat. You don't want to be blind. But it was called the Firefly, and that high-velocity round could penetrate the frontal armor of a tiger and a panther, no problem, at normal combat distances. So the Germans said, if you see the short-barreled Sherman, don't even worry. You can ignore it for a while. Look for the long-barreled Sherman. That one's dangerous. That one shoot first. Well, the British realized, hey, they're gunning for our Fireflies, so they put this mottled camouflage on there to make it kind of blend in with the bright background of the sky. From a distance, it looks like a short-barreled. That's easier to see. This is not as easy to see. So if they assume it's a not very dangerous short-barreled Sherman, they might try to come closer or ignore it for a while and get hit by the Firefly. In fact, that's what happened to the top German tank ace in World War II. The one who had scored more kills than any other tank commander, he went charging out after Shermans. He didn't realize the British had come up with a Firefly. He thought he was going against normal Shermans. And he got hit by a Firefly, and it blew his tank up so bad the turret blew 10 yards away. All the crew was killed instantly because it looked like it wasn't dangerous, but it really was. Now, this neighborhood is one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in World War II. This neighborhood was a major contributor to the downfall of the German Reich and the fall of the Japanese Empire. Why? Because this neighborhood is not a neighborhood. This neighborhood is the roof of the Boeing aircraft plant near Seattle, Washington. During World War II, they were afraid that the Japanese might pull a stunt like we did with Doolittle's raid, put medium bombers on aircraft carriers under cover of storms or whatever, bring them in close, launch them, and destroy the Boeing aircraft plant. So they decided to make the whole roof of the plant just look like an innocuous neighborhood. Looks like it's not dangerous, but it was the Boeing plant that produced the B-17 Flying Fortress that brought Nazi Germany to its knees and produced the B-29 Super Fortress that dropped the atomic bombs on Japan, ending World War II. So sometimes you want to look like you're not dangerous when you really are in order to confuse the enemy. But man wasn't the first one to come up with this idea. God did it first with this creature. Anybody know what this is? It's a dangerous predator if you're an insect. Well, it's hard to see because it camouflages so well with this orchid, but this might help you. Now, what is it? It's a praying mantis, and this particular one is colored to look like an orchid, and it is appropriately named the orchid praying mantis. Look like you're just leaves on a flower, like you're not dangerous, and you can confuse your opponent. Now, here we have a tree limb. Somewhere on this tree limb is a dangerous predator to bugs and ants. What is it? Well, it's called the wraparound spider, and it's so flexible and can wrap itself around that it looks just like a knot or a bump on a tree limb. It's right there, beautifully camouflaged. But if an ant comes crawling over it, it just reaches out and grabs it. Very effective camouflage. Now, here we have the A-10 Warthog, which has a Gatling cannon in its nose that rotates and shoots about 65 rounds per second of depleted uranium, which is 2.5 times denser than steel and can cut through the top armor of any tank in the world, used very effectively against Saddam Hussein and all of his tank forces in the Gulf War there. Now, what they did was they put an artificial canopy painted on the bottom so that we see it a little bit easier even here, false canopy, and that tends to confuse gunners or when opposing pilots trying to, you know, engage it, because if you don't know which end is which, you're not as sure which direction it's going to turn. Pilots usually turn in a direction that will produce positive G-forces because they can be more easily endured than negative G-forces. So if the canopy is facing you, it's more likely they'll turn for you than toward you than away from you. And just, you know, disorienting you as to what direction, what attitude the aircraft has can make you miss. And sometimes that's all it takes. We see that also in the Canadian Air Force. They put false canopies on the bottom of their F-18 Hornets. So have the Israeli Air Force. Now, they're not the first ones to think of that idea. God thought of it first. We see it here in these tropical fish. The real mouth and eye is located here. But when you see a big eye, you usually think, well, that's where the mouth is. And if there's a big eye and a big head, it probably has a big mouth. But actually, it has a little mouth and a little eye, and this is just a distraction to make them think it's facing one way when actually it isn't and give them an advantage to escape. And butterflies very often display a false eye, again, to deter predators thinking it's bigger than what it actually is. Now, here we have the serval cat. The serval cat has dark ears with this white slit in there to make it look kind of like eyes. When it's in tall grass, you know, those eyes seem to be peering out, and a predator trying to sneak up on it, say, oh, it's looking at me. I better sneak around this way. But when it does that, it comes in front of its real eyes, and it can see it and escape. Again, confusing the enemy by making it look like you have eyes where you don't. Now, submarines all use a certain principle to submerge and to ascend. What is that? They either take in or expel water to adjust their buoyancy. So this idea has been used from the first submarine in history to modern nuclear submarines today. You either take in water to submerge. When you want to surface, compressed air pushes the water out, makes you more buoyant, you come to the surface. But this idea used in submarines is not something man thought of first. God thought of it first and put it in this amazing creature. The chambered nautilus uses the very same principle of regulating buoyancy by taking in or expelling fluid, just like modern submarines. God invented it first. Now, here we have fiber optic cables, and almost all of our communication system is replaced with fiber optic cables because they're much more efficient, much more durable. They can carry a lot more information than copper wires. So almost all communications now that's carried by wire is by fiber optic cables. But even fiber optic cables is not something man invented first. God invented it from the beginning of creation, and if he didn't, you would not be able to see very well at all. Now, in the eye, we have at the back of the eye the place where the lens and the cornea focuses an image. And that surface is full of photoreceptor cells, okay? And it takes that image, translates it into electrical impulses that go down the optic nerve and is interpreted by the brain as visual awareness. Now, that thin little layer that we have there, the retina, it's about as thin as saran wrap. You know, if you ever use saran wrap, you know, it is quite thin. But at the molecular level, it's fairly thick. It's thick enough to have a number of cell layers in it. And when we look at the cross-section, we find as all these nerve cells and all their connecting wires, and all of these are in front of the incoming light in the image. Now, the cells that are important are down here at the bottom. They're the rod and cone cells that, you know, actually take that image and turn it into a visual image in your brain. So the light in the image has to get through this entangling forest of all these cells and get down to where it's needed here with the light-sensitive cells. But it looks like there's all this stuff in the way. And so evolutionists have said, well, this is a bad design. This must have evolved. God would be a good enough engineer that he would realize you don't put all this stuff in the way of the important light-sensitive cells, the rods and the cones. They should have been behind it. Actually, this is a brilliant design. This allows the eyes to be nourished properly. If you look at a bright light, maybe you glance at the sun or something, or somebody flashes your face with a camera, with a flash. If you didn't have this rapid replacement of these light-sensitive cells down here, and that takes nourishment and takes all this blood that we've got down here and all these, you know, various cells there, you could get the effect of snow blindness just by glancing at the sun or somebody flashing a camera in your face. And for several days, you'd be essentially blind. But with this design, that doesn't happen. But it does have all this stuff in the way. Well, my question to them is, if it's a bad design, why does it work so well? Maybe you don't understand everything about God's design. And in fact, we did not. Only in recent years did we find God invented optical fiber cables. And those cables have a big opening here, comes down through the cable, and it widens out here and delivers the light and the image directly through this entangling forest of ganglion and other neurons right down to where it's needed, to the rod and cone neurons. So he invented optical fibers first, and they're used in our eyes, and that's why we can see so well in spite of this design. It's not a bad design. It's a beautiful design, and it works very well. Now, many of you on your smartphones have an app that allows you to speak into your phone in English, and then it will speak back in, say, Spanish or whatever language you want it to translate into, or it will print out on the screen in Spanish, and you can communicate with someone, you know, without ever having studied Spanish or Russian or Chinese or whatever. Boy, that's really handy. You know, you speak into your phone, and then they listen or they look, and you can communicate with people that speak an entirely different language. Well, that's pretty cool. That wasn't developed until the 20th century, but it was there from the beginning of creation. God invented translation from one language to another. We already talked about that a little bit. We have to translate the DNA language, the blueprint for how to grow and maintain and run everything and reproduce everything. That has to be translated by a bunch of chemical machines, DNA, RNA, ribosomes, proteins. It is translated from DNA into RNA, and then finally from RNA into proteins. So translation from one language into another is not a new thing. And this looks somewhat simplified in this drawing, but it's far more complex than any cell phone, far more complex really than any machine man has ever created. And God put that amazing complexity for translation of one language into another in every living creature. And if it didn't have it, no living creature could live or reproduce. Now then, here we have a camcorder, which is becoming somewhat obsolete because our smartphones have such good cameras and even video on them nowadays that they're as good as camcorders were just several years ago. They're probably going to get better and better with time. But the idea of having an easily handheld video that gives you video and sound recording, that is not something new. God invented it first, of course, with the human eye, the optic nerve, and the processor, computer processor, called our brain. But this camcorder, so to speak, is vastly superior to any other camcorder. With our camcorders or our smartphones, we get sight and sound. But with this, all five senses input is recorded. Say you go to the ocean. You go, oh, it's so beautiful. You see it, sight. You hear the shrill call of the seagulls. You hear the crashing of the waves. But you also feel the cool breeze on your face. When the waves hit you, you feel the coolness of the water and the sand being pulled back between your toes. If the water splashes on you, gets in your mouth, you taste that briny, salty flavor of the ocean. So all five senses are experienced and recorded in this camcorder, plus something else, not just sight and sound and smell and touch, but what else? Emotion. You know, you may have gone there and said, boy, this is the most beautiful day I've ever had. We had a family reunion here, and whenever I think of that day, I just think of how beautiful it was and what a good time I had with my family, and you just get this warm feeling. Well, yeah, it's just five senses being recorded in your camcorder, but even the emotion of the time. No camcorder can do that. But God invented it first, and he invented it far better from the very beginning of time. Now, but you know what this is? An electric motor. What causes this motor to spin? The flow of certain charged particles, what are they called? The electrons. So it's a flow of negatively charged electrons. Thus, it's called an electric motor. But a rotary motor that's caused to rotate by the flow of charged particles is not something man invented. God invented it first with this amazing rotary motor. This is smaller than the propeller system you have on the E. coli bacterium. That has 40 different complex protein parts, and it is a true rotary propeller system, which is something you never see arise by chance. This is even smaller. This is only about 20 nanometers in length, a nanometer being a billionth of a meter. It has only 8 protein parts instead of 40, like the rotary propulsion system of the E. coli bacterium. And it rotates by the flow of charged particles, just like an electric motor, except the charge is opposite. Instead of electrons, which are negatively charged particles, it uses positively charged particles called protons. So it's called a proton motive force instead of an electromotive force. But it uses the same principle, just with different charged particles. This rotary motor has a powerhouse that builds up an energy gradient that causes the flow of these charged protons to go into it and rotate it. And it rotates it anywhere from a few hundred to a few thousand RPMs, okay, revolutions per minute. Now, it's mechanically induced, proton motive force, kind of like an electric motor with different protons being used instead of electrons. And up at the top, it has very specific proteins called enzymes. Enzymes catalyze chemical reactions. They force reactions to happen much, much faster than they normally would. So it rotates, and each complete rotation grabs onto an ADP molecule and bonds to it an inorganic phosphate molecule, producing this important molecule of life. Every living creature has to have that molecule at the cellular level, or it has no energy. So what is ATP? Well, living in the West, you should know. ATP is a wigwam, right? Native American dwelling. But in biology, ATP is an abbreviation for adenosine triphosphate. Adenosine is a nucleoside, and it has three inorganic phosphate molecules bonded to it. And the breaking off of that third phosphate molecule liberates chemical energy that the whole world of biology is designed to run on at the molecular level. So without ATP, life as we know it is impossible. Even bacterium, single-cell creatures, everything runs at the cellular level by ATP. That's why if you take cyanide, cyanide cripples one enzyme in this big metabolic, you know, kind of like a factory assembly line that extracts energy from food, and it cripples one enzyme, cytochrome oxidase, and that causes a chain reaction failure, which means no energy gets to these engines and they shut down, and you have no more production of ATP. See, it has to recycle ADP into ATP, and you have trillions of these cells, quadrillions of them, in the trillions of the cells of your body. And it does so much of this that every day, half your body weight at least is converted and recycled from ADP back into ATP and back again. Boy, that's a lot. So you have to have many thousands of these little rotary motors in your cells, and they have to be rotating and producing ATP and recycling it, or you have no energy. So when you take cyanide, it disrupts that cycle. The engine stops. No more ATP is produced. And what you have already in your cell, you know, it will use a billion ATP molecules on the average in a few minutes. That's why you take cyanide within a few minutes, you're dead. You literally die from a lack of energy at the cellular level. Talk about being dead tired. Well, you lose production of ATP, you're dead tired. You literally die from a literal lack of energy. So cyanide is very effective in stopping these things, but it's a true rotary motor at a nanometer scale. God put it there first. They exist by the quadrillions in the cells of your body. If these rotary motors that are like an electric motor, just using a different charged particle, positively charged instead of electrically charged, negatively charged, we could not exist. God invented it first, and it's the key to cellular energy being used in all biological life forms. Now, here we have cogged gear wheels, which are supposed to be a relatively modern invention. But even this is not something man invented first. God invented it first, and we see it here in the world of biology. Gear wheels with interlocking cogs or teeth. Wow, we didn't invent that. God invented it first. Where did he invent it? In this creature. This is called the leaf hopper. It's indigenous to Eastern Europe and certain parts of Northern Africa. And in its juvenile stage, it has to lock its rear legs because it jumps, you know, and it has to be able to jump straight. So if this tremendous energy that's released in its rear legs isn't perfectly balanced, it'd go to one way or the other, it'd miss its target, couldn't even, you know, go anywhere. It'd just fall over on one side if it's not evenly balanced. So God put in it these cogged gear teeth, just like we find in cogged gear wheels. This synchronizes both legs. So when that tremendous energy is expended, both legs are in sync lock, and they all jump in the same direction under control. So God invented it first. Well, what's the evolutionist response to all these amazing creatures? Every one of them we've seen today, by the way, is more complex than any machine man has ever invented or ever dreamed of inventing. How do they say it got there? Well, they can't acknowledge God because they hate God and they don't want to submit to him. So they say we usually think of gears as something we see in human-designed machinery. These gears are not designed. They are evolved, representing high-speed and precision machinery evolved for synchronization in the animal world. Well, I'd like to know where in the history of the world or the history of science we have ever seen high-speed precision machinery arise by time and chance and natural laws of chemistry and physics. It doesn't. It arises in our experience, scientifically and observationally, by one means alone. An intelligent author writes the blueprint. An intelligent engineer interprets the blueprint, builds the parts, puts them together, and makes it work. This type of design never arises. There's no scientific precedent. There's no observational precedent. They believe it by pure blind faith because they can't stand the concept of a creator to whom we are accountable. So they say, well, everything you see happened by evolution. No matter what you see, evolution did it. Really, put up or shut up. Show the experiments, show the math, show the physics, show the chemistry that shows that that works. They have nothing but bluff and bluster. Well, we're PhDs and you aren't. So, PhD doesn't make anybody infallible. Some of the biggest mistakes in the history of science were made by multiple PhDs. So what matters is the facts, evidence, and logic, and especially in science, what you can prove by experiment to be true. We can prove by experiment any laboratory in the world, that if you want to get information, you use an intelligent author. It works every time. You want to get complex machinery, use an intelligent designer and engineer to build it and put it together. It works every time. We can prove by repeated experimentation and observation, the backbone of science, we can explain what makes life tick at the molecular level, which is information, which is read by automated machines and used to build the whole complex sphere of biology. Somebody, an author, had to put the information there and create robotic molecular machines that know how to read it and build based on the blueprint. Where do we ever see anything like that happen without intelligence being involved? There is no scientific precedent. They simply say it as if saying it makes it true. I say, put up or shut up, show us experiments. I can show experiment any day. It shows intelligence, produces information, produces machines. Where's your experimental evidence to the contrary? They have nothing, just bluff and bluster. We do not have to be intimidated by them. Okay, so when we look at the world of biology, we see the amazing, inventive handiwork of God, where he invented all kinds of things before we ever thought of them. We invent things, we pat ourselves on the back, boy, we're really smart, look what we came up with. We look at biology and get humbled by the fact God already thought of it first, long before we did, at the beginning of creation. He had already thought of it, not only thought of it, but made it often more complex and more amazing, more efficient than any of our crude copies. But God, the great intelligent creator, he thought of it first. So God's attitude toward them is found in Romans chapter 1, verse 20, where the Apostle Paul wrote under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, "For ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature and attributes, that is, his eternal power and divinity, have been made intelligible and clearly discernible in and through the things that have been made, his handiworks." Today we've looked at just some of his amazing handiworks, and we see the intelligence that we thought of later. But if it took us intelligence to think of it later, it took God's intelligence to think of it first. If it takes man's intelligence, then it takes a higher intelligence to get what we find in the world of biology, because it outclasses anything, outstrips anything in our technology. So men are without excuse, altogether without any defense or justification. They may say, well, the majority of scientists believe in evolution. So the majority has been dead wrong many times in the history of science. And when it comes to whether or not there's a God that we're accountable to, the stakes are pretty high, like your eternal destiny. So I'm not just going to blindly accept what the scientists say. Being a scientist doesn't make them infallible. They're fallen, red-blooded human beings with pride, prejudice, preconceived ideas, and a rebellious nature against God. The Bible says that the man in the flesh cannot even submit to the law of God or the truth of God. He has to be touched by God's Holy Spirit, has to have a heart that says, I want the truth. But those who want the lie will never come to it. Jesus said, this is the condemnation. Light, truth has come into the world, and men loved darkness rather than light because their deeds were evil. And they hate the light and will not come to it, lest their evil deeds be exposed. If you acknowledge there's a God and you come to him and find out he's a holy God and that he wants us to be holy, he'll give us the power, he'll give us the forgiveness, he gives us the power to do it. But he demands if we have fellowship with him, we have to be holy. And he will make us perfectly holy in the end. When we see him, we'll be like him. I look forward to that. I'm going to be perfect for all eternity. I'm not now, but I'm going to be perfect in my love toward God, my love toward my fellow man for all eternity. What an awesome eternity. Can you imagine? But you have to acknowledge the truth. There is a God who created us, a God of love, who demands that we live by his horrible law, that we love the Lord our God with our whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love our neighbor as ourself. Isn't that horrible? No, we all know in our hearts that's really the right thing to do. But wicked men didn't get their fame and glory and power by living by that law of love. They did it by crawling over and stepping on anybody they had to get what they wanted. And to acknowledge God and his law of love means they have to give up their sin that they love. Thus they hate the light, and they will not come to the light lest their evil deeds be exposed. But God says, you're still without excuse. The creation itself shows the truth of an almighty, infinite, powerful creator. And there's no escaping that. You can deny it, but they deny it without any facts, without any proof. It's just a denial. Saying it doesn't make it so. The facts show that it is true. And they had better get their act together and repent before it's too late. God will start soon shaking the earth. Biblical prophecy will be fulfilled. And hopefully then, at least, they'll come to their senses. But in the meantime, we do not have to be intimidated by their arguments. They have no real science or experiments to support what they believe. So, I do have this available on DVD out there. It's $15. If you buy three, you get a fourth one free. And we've run out of time, so I'll go ahead and turn this over to the powers that be. Thank you very much for coming out this morning.